Welcome to the Edinburgh Fringe Show. It's July, we're previewing, we're meeting some of the people who are going to be heading to Edinburgh, and today is JD Shapiro. Yes, good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Edinburgh still belongs to Edinburgh, but that will all change come August as the Edinburgh Festival Fringe descends on the city and turns it into the arts capital of the world. When we get to that point, the Fringe Show podcast, Shing Me Dig Malarkey, where we bring you interviews, news and thoughts and opinions throughout the month of August. But July is a time for us to do previews, to catch up with some of the artists who've been at the Fringe before, some who are making their debut, and find out how they're feeling about their show, their life, their career, and what's brought them to this moment. As mentioned there at the top of the show, JD Shapiro is our first guest from New York. You will never guess that from the accent. Over from Hollywood and various roles and jobs there as well. Writer, script doctor, director, stand-up comic, name dropper extraordinaire. Although when you are working in Hollywood, it's not name dropping if you're just saying my mate, whoever. Anyway. Just such a diverse character who made the decision to come to the Fringe last year and has made the decision to come again this year. It's a really interesting conversation. It's about the stage as being a home, not just a performance space. It's how about you have to tailor a show and change it for the audiences, especially those at Edinburgh. And yeah, why come back? It's JD Shapiro. The show is Stories from the Hood to Hollywood, playing at Just the Tonic 520 from the 3rd through to the 27th. Joining me now on the Edinburgh Fringe Show, a man who has had many, many ups, many, many downs, highs and lows, JD Shapiro joins me now. Welcome, JD.
Thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it.
I noticed on your press releases that it's small J, capital D. It's not J.D. Tell me about that.
It's been in many incarnations. I don't know. For some reason, I just saw it. Someone once wrote it once like that, and it as a credit by mistake. And I went, oh, I like that. It's just different. So I thought, I'll go with it. There's unfortunately, there's no real interesting story behind it other than I saw it on a credit. When they make the credits for movies, and I was like, "Huh, that's kind of cool. I'm gonna do that."
Anything that gives you a slight advantage in, oh, I remember that person, is always a win. You know that in entertainment as much as I do.
Yeah, I guess subconsciously it was like, because you're the first person to ask that question, so that means other people have obviously noticed it a lot. And right, it's a slight advantage.
I'm just the most inquisitive one, or the one that just has such a low bar in social interactions. I can ask why your name looks funny.
Yeah, but I love it.
You mentioned movie credits there, so let's start then. People who do read movie credits, hello, yep, I know what a key grip is, may will have seen that name. Tell us a little bit about what you do in the movies and why that's a lot of your life.
So started out mostly writing movies, then became a creative consultant on movies. So creative consultant is where I'm hired by movies to either rewrite a script or what's known punch up a script, either add humor or add story, both drama and comedy and action. Well, I guess that's three, that's not both. And there are times I'm brought on a set to give help and advice. And then other times where it's when post-production and I'll see like a 4-hour cut. And then it's me trying to figure out with the director, sometimes the producer, sometimes the star who can also be a producer of the movie, how to find this, how to get rid of all the stuff and find the story. That happens more in comedies than anything else, where because sometimes you forget as a filmmaker, you still have to have a story. So working that with dramas as well, it's like fine, you know, like, okay, what this scene isn't working, it's taking away from it. Because every scene should move a story forward, except for comedy. Comedy is the one where the only genre where you can actually kind of stop the film, have a really funny moment, and then continue. So anyway, so I'll work on those. Most of those I have to sign what's known as an NDA, non-disclosure, because directors in Hollywood can be very particular, and they don't particularly like other people having being known that they've done things. Like many years ago, the Directors Guild, you're not allowed to write, used to be a casting director. Now it's a casting associate, as well as directing a few movies. My first movie I ever directed was something called We Married Margot, which I shot it on film, three different film stocks, for $280,000. Knowing what I know now, if anyone handed me the script and said, I'll give you $280,000 to make this movie, I'd be like, you're insane, I need $5 million. But somehow pulled it off, did well, got a lot of attention. We won the HBO Comedy Festival. That's where I met Robin Williams, who was the one who talked me into doing stand-up over many years. We became friendlies. And George Lucas became a real big fan of the movie and invited me to Skywalker and gave me great advice and gave me a complete free sound mix, which was hundreds of thousands of dollars. To do for free when New Line decided to buy it, because I had to change out. I had music in. I had what's known as a temp track, which means music that I didn't really own the rights to. For example, I had the Beatles, and I literally, the line was, she came in through the bathroom window. That was it. So the publishing company, since I was making an independent, offered me a deal, and I could have it for $250,000. And I said, oh, that's $30,000 less than my budget. So George Lucas was very kind, whatever, became a big fan, and it was an amazing experience. And then so directing other movies for there, many I've taken my name off of, many I've turned, I was known for turning down a lot of projects. I was very particular, I still am very particular. For me, it's about the passion. I grew up very poor, so it never was about the money. When I started making the type of money I started making, I was, holy crap. It was always for me about, like, is okay, the only way I'll write a movie or direct a movie is if it's something, if I'm like flipping through the channels and I see a movie that I've seen a bunch of times, and I might even have that movie on streaming or on, well, I don't have DVDs anymore, but if I have that movie and I'm gonna watch it, even though I'm in the middle of it, those are the movies that I wanna write and direct. And I have a difference of level. There's like movies that I really wanna write, but I don't necessarily think I'm the particular person to direct it. I think someone else can come in and hopefully take what I've done and even enhance it. That's the go. When I write something for me to direct, or I'm offered something to direct, that's even more. I better want to watch this all the time, because you put so much of your, you put, first of all, you know, even on a small budget movie, you're talking about 8 months of your life. On a typical movie, it could be anywhere from 10 to 12 months. So, and then you have all the press junkets and all the other stuff that goes with it. And it was, okay, I'm going to drop a name. In the show, I drop a lot of names, but these are people I actually did have relationships or met. Now, this was someone I did not have a relationship, but we met a few times. And Steven Spielberg said to me, every time he chooses one movie to direct, there's 50 movies he wants to make that he'll never get to make. And that kind of stuck with me. And so that's my filmmaking career right now. I got crushed like everyone during COVID. I had a movie in Switzerland that was about to go, World War II, serious drama based on a woman who helped change the course of the war. But because of COVID is when I decided to do The Fringe last year. So there was good and bad. And then right now things are picking up again, although most people, I don't know if you know it, what's going on in the United States with movies, is there's the writer's strike, SAG strike. I think the Directors Guild settled, which they always do, which screws up everyone else. And I am a director. But the guild itself, sometimes you're just like, oh, come on. But anyway, that's, you know. And so, yeah, so I've got some other movies and a TV series that might be made. And if I do it right, it's a satire on Francisco Franco. And it's based on a true story. He wrote a book called Raza under the assumed name. I'm in Madrid right now, and I love living in Madrid. But chances are I'll have to leave Madrid, because the satire is a TV series. It's a limited TV series, and it's called, he wrote a book, and then there was a movie made out of it. And all historians believe he really directed the movie. He was on the set every day and da-da-da. And I was like, oh my God, this is, I love satire, which to me is the hardest to write out of any genre, but I had so much fun writing it. Normally when I write something, I'll write it, if it's based on truth, I'll do very little research, and then I'll write from the imagination, and then I'll do the research. Because imagination is so powerful, you take away from it. This one, I started at that one, I was like, I gotta do research. And it just happened to be the time period, which was 1941 to 1942. So much was happening in the world. And I was giggling while I'm writing the script, because the idea is it's called Generalissimo. Francisco Franco is still dead, which is from a Saturday Night Live skit that became very famous. And the tagline is, directing a film is harder than dictating a country. So although it's a TV series, it's the behind the scenes, we found the behind the scenes footage. So the TV series is the behind the scenes footage. And we see as Franco is directing, he's more and more interested in directing, becoming a director, than he is in being a dictator. And if anyone has been on a film set, they know a director is a dictator. So it's. I mean, they're not getting people shot. Well, not all of them, but you know. So, is Spain ready for this? That's the question. I've met with Alex de la Iglesia and Carolina, who are very big. Unfortunately, they're busy with 30 coins, and I think Alex is a little bit worried about it. So I'm waiting to hear from some other people now, because I would like this to be a Spanish production, but it could also be a Spanish-American production, because actually Alex was like, what if we shot it in English? And I was really surprised, and he felt, because the other thing that I realized was all of these things that were happening in this particular TV series are happening now, especially in the United States. The whole rise of fascism, the whole putting down of women, the whole fear of the other. So that's where it became. It's funny, before the show you asked me, did I want to plug anything? I said no. I just spent 10 minutes plugging my TV series.
Great. Now you forced me to leave it in the edit. Congratulations. Well done. But that does lead me to something else, because you've got all these movie projects, directing, writing, script doctor, but then you move into comedy, and specifically stand-up. And that's a one-shot. Yeah. You can rehearse and you can rehearse, but you can't go up on stage and chop and change scenes and work on that. You've got to react live with no safety net.
Okay, no, it's a very, very, very different skill set. When I started doing it, a comedian said to me, your stand-up needs to catch up with your writing. Meaning, because I came from the world of writing, which many of the greats did, Steve Martin, Richard Pryor, Gary Shandling, because I had that. But when I started to go on stage, I realized it's a very, very different form of craft, because it's like you said, it's what I have a line that doing stand-up is like walking a tightrope over poor sharks while the audience is hacking at the tightrope with a machete. So that, and also I'm actually shy. I get anxiety when I leave the house, and I don't like being in crowds. So add that to the fact of why I started doing stand-up. So yes, it's a very different, I had to learn to adjust of the writing, because I'm alone in a room. I mean, unless it's a TV series, then you have a writing room, but when you're doing a movie, you're alone in a room with your demons, gnawing at you. And when you're on stage, you have to be in the moment. That's what I love about, I suffer from manic depression, and being in the moment to me changes, is the game changer. And that first was writing. And then unfortunately, I fell in love with, Robin Williams had been bugging me in a sense, talked me into doing it finally. Took a while, I finally did it because I was scared to death. But yes, it's a very different, it's like, but I did learn something. In the beginning, I literally had all my notes and I was reading my notes. It was terrible, And then as I gradually started to, because I was worried about my dyslexia as well, why I became a writer. Let's put it like this. If someone hands me low hanging fruit, I'm like, the hell with that, give me Mount Everest. So it's a very different thing, but also the juice, the energy, musicians talk about this a lot more, I think, than comics do, but it's the same thing. We do feed off the audience. And that's not pandering. It's that, like, when you have an audience that is, like, really into it, you can play more. And the other thing that I learned was I actually liked playing. There was a show I did, which was on. It was mostly students from Pepperdine in California, and it was about, I'd say, about 300-400 people in the room. And comics are just, I don't know if you've ever seen Blues Brothers, but there's a scene where they're playing in a cage and people are throwing stuff at them. That's pretty much what this is like without the cage and people throwing. Yeah, they're booing and everything. And everyone is tanking. And I'm only been doing it about a year at this point. And something happened. I walked on stage and I realized, wait a second, this isn't a comedy club. This is their home. I'm in their home. And I threw out my set list and I was supposed to do, at that time, 6 minutes, because newer comic, everything. I threw out my set list and it went amazing. I looked over at the booker, the showrunner, and he just kept going like this, meaning keep going, keep going. I ended up doing over 20 minutes. And when I left, the audience was no, no, no. And that was a big breakthrough. And now on stage, I play more. I will do, my show will be different every night. And the theme will be the same. So that's another difference, where in a movie, once you've written it, and obviously there's all these hands that come in and make terrible changes, why there's so many bad movies. But in this, I get to write it, direct it, perform it, screw it up, or get it right. And it's just, it's live. Like, I've had literally one time I had a studio executive go, can I read the script? He'd already bought it. It was Paramount. I was like, yeah. And he goes, no, while you're here. And I'm like, what? No, I don't want to hear my script. I don't even read my scripts. No. So this is much more, like you said, you used the word no safety net. There's no safety net. Zero. I don't even have a guitar. Like, you know, as a band, you most of the time, and there are singers who sing without it, but you do have a bit of a character, and there are obviously comedians who play characters. And Steve Martin was brilliant at that, but it's still raw and naked and you're exposed. And it's like you said, there's no safety net. Where writing is definitely much more of a safety net, and directing is much more of a safety net.
You talked about coming into a home there as a metaphor for going into different venues. You're coming back to Edinburgh. But what was it like walking in to Edinburgh last year? What did our home feel like to you in 2022?
What happened was, I was planning to do what would be called typical stand-up, you know, bits, routines and stuff. And a person from Cork had seen me do like a 25-minute set here that went great in Madrid. And then I started doing, I didn't do many, I didn't get a chance, I was busy, but I started to work on the one-hour show. And it became more storytelling. Actually, my ex-wife, who's Madridian, or actually she's Basque, we're very good friends. She was pushing me to tell stories, because like, your stories are great. My dad was an amazing storyteller, and I guess I got it from him. He was terrible at jokes, though. He told dad jokes, but you know.
Did he ever see your films? I'm sorry, huge diversion, but did he ever see your films and your writing there?
My dad and my mom separately, they were divorced. They saw all my films, even the ones where my name's, yeah, they were very, when I announced I'm going to LA to be a writer, my dad was like, that's great. What are you going to do for a living?
He's writing those classic script lines already, isn't he?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a diversion there. Back home.
No, that's great. No, my parents, I have three heroes. My mom, my dad, who are both very flawed. And then my one hero who I don't find any flaws to is Bugs Bunny. So what happened was, so my friend from Cork was like, yeah, I'm going to do a really bad Irish accent. And I do the bad accent, saying it's bad accents. And I actually had some newspapers last year say, oh my God, his accent is terrible. But I say it's a bad accent because Americans think it's brilliant. But we don't know anything about other cultures. So anyway, my friend McCorkle says, you've got to do the stories. You've got to do the, they love the stories. Storytelling is an art form. You've got to do the stories. So it became much more storytelling. So the first night I did it was a disaster. It was, now there weren't that many people in the crowd. I'd say there was about 30. My producer was there and the publicist from last year, and they were just like, what are you doing? You're like, this, where's the humor? And I'm like, well, there's a lot of humor in it. And they're like, but you're, and they went through certain cultural things. So we sat down the next day and they went through like, now I don't pander, but I also understand, like, meaning a lot of my comedy is about my views of marketing and religion being the two biggest evils. But I'll do it in the South and in the United States. Oh, and I will get booed and pushed back. I'm actually surprised no one took a punch at me. But they were like, okay, culturally this, that, and you need to. And so the next day I worked on it, you know, knowing what I wanted to do. And I'm pretty, like, if someone gives me an idea, especially it was David Burns, and he gave me ideas that clicked. And so I was able to rework the show. And then two days later, the other producer came, and it was a 109 seat theater. I think that day was probably about 80 people. And the other producer looked at Michael, the other producer, and went, "What are you talking about? This show is amazing." So I learned to adjust, but in a way that I wanted to play. And the adjustments were, one of the things was, because I do drop so many names, is not coming across as a name dropper, as coming across as someone who, these are people I worked with. It's because again, I grew up really poor. I ran around with an Irish gang called the Westies. Now I was 11 years old, but I wasn't a member, but I grew up in what was Hell's Kitchen, when it was considered one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the world. So I should have been either in prison or dead, considering, and also my mom was in a very lower class neighborhood in Jersey. So it was a very eclectic growing up, in the sense that, you know, it was a lot of dumb things I did. And at some point I went from destroying to creating. But so the names are important, because if I just say, oh, this is a story about, like, you know, Bill Brown, it's like, huh? So what I realized is I changed how I opened up the show. And I literally say, listen, I'm going to drop a lot of names. And then they tell the difference between someone who is a name dropper in Hollywood, and they exist. It's like, hey, I just saw George's movie. I'm like, you've never met George Clooney. Okay. In a conversation, you say their first and last name. If you know them and spent time with them and become friends with them or worked with them and known them, then in a conversation, you can say their first name. But otherwise, give them the respect and say their first and last name. So that was like, and I said, you're going to see the difference here, because there were people I talked about. Like, I would never say Steven as Steven Spielberg. I would say Steven Spielberg. But I can say Stan. I can say Stan for Stan Lee. For George Lucas, because of the time we spent together, working together and doing things. So that was a big, that just opening changed a lot, that people didn't look like that I was a Hollywood word I can't say here. And that changed. And then I moved up a couple of stories, switched things around, got rid of some things. And so I got to embrace, understand, the Scottish culture. And then I had a lot of fun, because there was a bit that I had that I didn't realize how the Scots felt about. I don't think I'll give it away. Here's shameless plug. You have to come to see my show. But I knew the Scots didn't like this particular person from England. But like, it was a bit that just went over huge. And so I moved it to another spot. So it was moving things around. It was changing things. And it was learning about, I'd never done a festival before, and the hour shows I'd only done a few 1 hour shows. Most of my shows when I was, I was the middle act. So I only did stand up for a few years. I was a couple years. I was very lucky. Mitzi Shore made me a paid regular at the Comedy Store, which was a huge badge of honor. She thought I'd been doing it for 10 years, and then someone ratted me out, and she's like, oh, I thought you'd been doing me doing it a year and a half. I thought you'd been doing it for 10 years. I'm like, well, what does that matter? But anyway, so she punished me for a month and gave me a lousy spots, and then she gave me great spots again. But so most of my shows were 30 or 40 minutes. And then sometimes I was doing the main room or other things, and that was an hour show. So, but I hadn't done it consistently, never had done it a month in a row. My schedule just didn't allow me to. And then I'd stopped doing, before last year's show, the last time I did stand-up was 5 years prior to that. So, but for some reason, I fell in love with the town or the city and the people, and met many. I was really lucky. I met friends that will be from life, from different areas of Scotland, someone from Australia, someone from the United States. But anyway, I learned how different cultures are. I never traveled growing up. When I got married, my wife and I traveled a lot because she's European, but had not been, I'd been to London, but I'd never been to Scotland, which I'd always wanted to go to for many reasons. And so it was this, you know, it was like grasping on to like people, and the storytelling is what worked, seemed to work the best. I still had, I always threw in stuff with, that worked with, like when I talk about writing Battlefield Earth, right, and that's not my script on the screen, but that's when I can go into my...
I'm sorry, there was a script on the screen? Look it there up, kids. Look it up, kids.
Yeah, there should have been a script on the screen. It would have been a much better movie. Just the entire script for an hour and a half, and people would have loved it much better than the movie. Yeah, and my name is on it. That's a whole story I do talk about.
So why come back to Edinburgh then?
Quite candidly, there was a woman I met.
And roll credits.
I met her the last day I was there. I asked her out on a date, and she was like, I can't, my son is starting Scouts. And I didn't think she was interested in me at all. And it was at a charity shop that gives money to fight cancer. And I've had too many people in my life, unfortunately, and animals pass away of cancer. So I made a donation. Anyway, I get to that because, okay, I didn't think she was interested. About a week later, she emailed me, and we ended up talking for a while and became friendly, and I started to develop feelings for her, and I thought maybe she was developing feelings for me. So I went to Edinburgh for 2 weeks and I said, look, I'm coming. I was staying at a hotel. I said, no expectations, let's see. And it worked out great. Actually, her son and her are now here in Madrid. They're right now at the Real Madrid Stadium. Her son is a really great striker for a club, 12 years old, you know, so it's he goes into high school, but he's obvious. It's funny, his heart team, they're originally from Sheffield. So his heart team is the opposite of his mom's, the two teams that are rivals, which is pretty funny. But yeah, basically because of a woman. And then I had a choice of three different agents wanted to represent me, two at the United States and one out of London. And even though the London group was smaller, I just felt I really connected with them. And they talked me into doing the festival again, because quite frankly, the festival itself, you might know this, it lost 33% in ticket sales. It was all about the money last year. It wasn't about the artists. It wasn't about the people coming. I ended up thinking, well, maybe I'm a newbie and I didn't know, but I ended up talking with became friends or friendly with a lot of the comedians or performers who have been doing it for 5, 10 years, and newbies as well. We all had the same complaints. And then I'd speak to people who either came to my show or didn't. And they're like, oh, yeah, we can't afford to go to too many shows, and it's so expensive. So we're here. We're doing a lot of the free fringe or the outdoor acts. My tickets, I had said I wanted my ticket sales to be £8. Somehow it was £12. Now normally I fully read the contract, but I trusted the producers, and okay. And then there was another $1.50. If you ordered online, and there was no app, this app that people talked about that I didn't know this year there's going to be. And also apparently they'd received like 200,000 or 250,000 from the government. And it just went, I don't know. It felt like it was all about the money. So I wasn't going to do it again. But then my agents talked me. I decided to do a smaller venue because I wanted to do a more intimate show. To do a small intimate room is the greatest thing in the world. You know, it's almost like, Kurt Cobain on MTV Unplugged, or Elvis when he did the 1968 tour, or the Beatles when they did that comeback and they did it on the roof. It's like there's something about that. And every comedian I've spoken to talks about the limit is 2,500. And that sounds like a lot of people, and it is. But after that, it's still at that point, it's very difficult to connect with the crowd. You're almost not faking it, but you're trying to, and then you get bigger than that. And I have performed in bigger than that. And it's very strange, but a small intimate room, it feels like people are there and it's, they're in your house and, you know, they're your guest. And that, by the way, is much riskier though, because in a small room, this is a 50 person room. If even if it's packed, which is 50 people, you know, if one or two people don't like the show, that could affect the entire audience. So it's a little more riskier, but it's so much more fun when it works because there's an intimacy to it. Yeah, this was the question. Do I know when my act is?
I prepped you. The one question I prepped you for, JT.
The one question I'm prepped for. I'm in the attic room at 5:20 p.m. every night, except on the 14th, they give me a day off where I can go and spend the day on a King Arthur's seat.
Indeed, yeah, that's Just the Tonic. As always, details on your show are going to be back on our website, which is edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com, and we have links into the box office and the ticket office and all of that there. But if people want to find out more about you, JD, what about your own website, socials, personals, wherever, where can we find more about you?
Okay, the best way is my website, which is the easiest to remember. It's jdshapiro.com. There you can find a bunch of the movies I did and clips and other nonsense that's on there.
And more nonsense storytelling when you come into our home, when you get to Edinburgh. Really looking forward to it. JD Shapiro, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was very enjoyable. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to coming to your hometown.
JD Shapiro there, stories from the hood to Hollywood. As always, you'll find links back to the websites, ticket office, bookings and everything back at our website, edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com. If you're listening on the website, come back there for the next preview. If you're on your podcast feed, then, you know, just stay steady. We'll have that in your feed soon enough. July is previews. The Fringe is coming. We'll be with you far more often in August. I'm just going to build up the stamina as we get there. As always, thanks for listening to the show. More coming up soon. But for now, I'll say ta-ra from the Edinburgh Fringe and catch you in the next show. You've been listening to the Edinburgh Fringe Show, hosted by Ewan Spence, produced by The Podcast Corner. Listen to more from The Fringe at edinburghfringe.thepodcastcorner.com.